If you recognize that music, well, first of all, that means you aren't on today's panel because it's from the work of Kendrick Lamar, which today's panel of the Nose is not necessarily that cognizant of or comfortable with, but it's going to be our first topic on the show today, kind of for that reason. This week, the Pulitzers on Monday were announced, and Kendrick Lamar won for music. Now, that's not just really surprising in the sense of a hip-hop artist winning for music. It's surprising, it's unprecedented for really any kind of popular artist ever winning a Pulitzer Prize for music. The closest you could come might be Wynton Marsalis, but he won it for an oratorio. The only piece of music that's ever won a Pulitzer for music that you would recognize, unless you're a Ned Roram fan or something, you know, Elliot Carter person, if you're just sort of a regular, normal music consumer, would be Appalachian Spring by Copland. One of Ives' symphonies also won. But so for Kendrick Lamar to win, very surprising. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that Kendrick Lamar has necessarily penetrated the consciousness of everybody. We're going to talk about that in the first segment. In the second segment, something you can relate to, why are restaurants so noisy? Why do they seem to they're getting noisier and noisier with each passing year, it seems. And we'll talk a little bit about that. There are reasons for it and then things we should be done about it. We'll take a little break after that. We'll do a little bit of a short pledge break. We'll come back with this terrific panel and we'll talk about Lost in Space, which has been rebooted on Netflix. We'll also make some recommendations for you. And with that, it's time to introduce the panelists. Rand Richards Cooper is a contributing editor at Commonweal and writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine. Carolyn Payne, actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance. Irene Papoulis teaches writing at Trinity College. This is like an all-star Nose panel. You guys have been with us for a pretty long time. Carolyn's like the newcomer. And how many years have you been doing this?
Now? I don't know. A lot.
She's an old fogey and she's young.
That's right. It's like life in a Turkish prison. Just lose track of time after a while. all right. So we are going to begin with this notion anyway that Kendrick Lamar surprised the world. A five-member music panel that judges the Pulitzers gave him the Pulitzer for the work, the album Damn. We'll hear. Well, actually, this kind of was the single off of Damn way back last summer. It's called Humble. We'll hear a little bit of it right here.
Nobody pray for me. It been a day for me. Yeah.
Hey, I remember syrup sandwiches and crime allowances. Finessing on them with some counterfeits, but now I'm counting this. Parmesan with my accountant lips. In fact, I'm down in this. You say with my boo babe tastes like Kool-Aid for the analyst. Girl, I can buy a Westie World with my base stuff. I know that it's good. Won't you sit it on my taste buds? I get way too petty. Won't you let me do the extras? Pull up on your block and break it down. We playing Tetris. AM to the PM, PM to the AM phone.
All right, so some people who have not won the Pulitzer include Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and you can actually go back. I mean, Richard Rodgers never won a Pulitzer for music. Cole Porter never won a Pulitzer for music. The list of famous people who have never won a Pulitzer for music is a very, very, it's all the list of really famous American musicians until Kendrick Lamar. So, but on the other hand, as we started getting ready to talk about this today, I discovered that nobody on the panel had much familiarity with Kendrick Lamar or was super comfortable talking about it. Although, Irene, you conceded that this raised an interesting question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Why is it something that when we hear those first opening notes, a lot of a certain demographic says, oh, I don't like that kind of music, period, and doesn't want to hear any more. And those are the people that who criticize their parents for not liking rock and roll, probably, except there's also some younger people who also feel the same way. and so I looked up the video and saw, of one of the songs and saw that, first of all, Don Cheadle is in it, who I love. He's one of my favorite actors. And second of all, there were 163 million plus views. And I said, why, this is wrong that I'm, and also it's a really, really interesting political commentary. And so I said, wait a minute, this is a problem.
Yeah, I was kind of mad at myself. I have to confess, this is so embarrassing, but I was like, who's Kendrick Lamar? I had to Google. And then I, realized like, oh, well, I've heard him, in music collaborations and I've heard his stuff, but I just hadn't really put together who he was. And I like rap and hip hop music, but I think I think I've sadly reached this made me realize that I reached that point where you don't, it's harder to, you don't discover as much new music, I think, at a certain age sometimes. Like, I have satellite radio in my car, and I'll listen to, like, 90s music and 2000s, and I'll, like, listen to those stations. So I kind of, I feel like now I haven't stepped into, I have not stepped into this era of music, clearly, because I am not with it.
That's interesting, too, because, you know, I think you'd also have to concede, although you haven't lived long enough to know how incredibly true this is, it's never been easier to discover new music or to discover anything you want.
Right, why that's shameful. Yeah.
I mean, it's if you got interested suddenly this week on Monday because Kendrick Lamar won for Damn, you know, if you have Spotify or Tidal or iTunes or almost anything, but certainly any kind of streaming service, immediately you could just pop it right on there and start listening to it. You don't have to walk down the street. You don't have to buy anything. You literally don't have to buy anything, and you can listen to the whole thing. Yes.
The flip side of the fact that it's so easy is that paradoxically, in some ways, it becomes so hard because there's such a surfeit in so many cultural fields of possibilities that to keep up you sort of have to choose your areas. I mean, there's an article about you read an article in Times. What new shows, what new series on Netflix are worth picking out of the Netflix stream? Mm-hmm. They use some fishing metaphor, and then you know, I'm looking at, oh, here are like these 16 new series on Netflix. So I'm trying to keep up with that. We all define area. For instance, with the Pulitzer, Andrew Sean Greer won for literature. I've never read. I know who Andrew Sean Greer is, but I haven't read him. You know, literature and writing is sort of my thing. Music isn't really. So it's like, I got to get onto Andrew Sean Greer before I get to Kendrick Lamar. Kendrick Lamar.
Kendrick Lamar.
Right.
Getting uncomfortable.
But nailing it.
So like Carolyn, I mean, I'm decades older than Carolyn, and I sort of add one new musical input probably like every 3 years, mm-hmm. and it's often because it's something I hear on the Colin McEnroe show, you know, that I like. So the shelves are crowded. There's not much space, and certain areas are actually full and closed down. The other thing I want to say is what's interesting about this prize is the Pulitzer. I mean, that's the other thing we obviously have to talk about. Prizes have brands, and you know the brand of the Pulitzer is being extended, changed, remodeled, and completely reconceptualized. If you look at that list of who's won the Pulitzer for music, as Colin said, you know, Aaron Copland would be one of the most popular figures on it. So what does it mean to take a prize, as was done with Dylan and the Nobel Prize for Literature, that has always been limited and exclusionary, and boom, you know, just take the lid off.
I think
now anything's possible.
It's a way of deliberately introducing someone into a certain kind of general popular culture that I think is a really good idea.
I don't agree with that, but I want to hear more about what you think about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, I just think the fact that a lot of people who would not otherwise have listened to Kendrick Lamar now will is a good idea, as opposed to sort of perpetuating the same kind of genres that we're used to listening to.
I agree with that. You know? Yeah. But I don't think that's why the Pulitzer people did that.
Cited those criteria. Well,
yeah.
I mean, those.
Well, so David Hadju, is one of the five judges, said, first of all, the difference between Dylan and Kendrick Lamar, there are a lot of differences, but I mean, is that the Nobel, they sort of go, you know what, yeah, well, all right, you're awesome. You know, we figured that out. It took a few decades, but you're great. Here's your Nobel, which he got in literature also, which is complicated, but there isn't a Nobel for him to win in music. In the case of the Pulitzer Prize for Music, it is given for a specific work. It is, you get it for one work that you've done. It's why, you know, Gershwin and Jerome Kern were not ever eligible for a Pulitzer, because by the time the Pulitzer came into existence, Gershwin was dead. Kern had 2 years left in his life. Even Irving Berlin was no longer doing his best work. So it's a specific work, and they looked at this work, this album called Damn, and said it hangs together in a way that, first of all, makes it a specific work, the way a symphony or other set of music would work. And we think it's the best thing all year.
And it speaks to the issue. At least the video that I watched, I can't even remember the title of that particular.
That was DNA.
Yes, right, exactly. And of police brutality and frustration in such a really, really important way that I think is really powerful, that people should pay attention to. It's sort of like a howl of of anger and frustration, and that is probably also why they chose it.
All right, we're going to switch gears to the noisy restaurants. I would quickly say that if you want to try to sort of have a little ramp to get up onto the Kendrick Lamar thing, first of all, to Pimp a Butterfly, his previous CD is, I think, a little bit, or album, is a little bit more accessible. And on this one, I would recommend the songs God and Fear, both of which are softer and use some found sound and some kind of almost prettier music, and maybe that's a easier way for people to go. All right.
So, you know, Colin, one last thing. The Pulitzer is such an avatar of sort of establishmentarian success. I heard someone on the radio talking about how when Joan Baez appeared on the cover of Time magazine, you know, people wondered, oh, no, is that the end? Can you still be a sort of, you know, transgressive, interesting, cool music artist once the such establishmentarian honors have been bestowed on you?
Well, to that point, Kendrick Lamar, who this panel barely has any acquaintance with, has been on the cover of Rolling Stone 3 or 4 times, on the cover of Time magazine, and on the cover of Forbes magazine. So you're sort of wondering,
wow,
like,
what
does it take to get famous these days?
That's a great question.
So, but anyway, we have to move on. Restaurants are very noisy. Quite a few years ago, my son and I went to Fatty Crab in the West Village on Hudson, which was at that point, it was kind of the it restaurant, getting all these reviews. We sat down, and I don't think we heard a word that either one of us said to the other the entire time. It was deliberately, purposely, incredibly noisy. See, this is Carolyn's show to be an old person.
Apparently, I'm like some cranky old person telling kids to get off my lawn.
She's not down with Kendrick Lamar. Now she's going to complain that restaurants are too noisy.
They are. It is awful. So, like I said in email, if you're a person out there dating and you go out to dinner on a dinner date, and especially if it's like a first date or like early on, and you are trying to talk and get to know this person, you just are ending up with a headache, and you're coming home hoarse, and it makes the first date even more miserable of an experience than it would have been.
He could have told you he was an axe murderer, and
I wouldn't have heard it, and we would have gone on a second date, and it would have ended really badly for me. So,
does anybody like them? I mean, do you have friends that say, "Oh, great, it's noisy, let's go"?
No, I would not be friends with that person.
Yeah. So then, how come they're so popular?
So many restaurants like I've walked into, and I'm like, oh no, they have a live band tonight. We got to go.
But it's not there's so much the live band, right? There's a decibel level of people talking, and there's a way that these restaurants are acoustically designed so that they don't do any of the things that they could just to abate that noise. And yeah, maybe there's some kind of music, some tape music in the background. Well, let's go to the restaurant critic over here.
Well, I think there's a combination of factors, and there are some underlying structural realities. And then beginning in the 1980s, especially in big cities, places like New York, where restaurant culture is formed, you have a steady upward spike in real estate prices, in rents, and a corresponding premium on efficient use of space in the restaurant. In other words, less square footage per table.
So you're practically sharing a table with the people next to you.
There's a financial imperative to, obviously, if you can squeeze the extra X number of tables in, you're going to make more money. So there is a sort of objective structural factor behind it. But there's also, and everyone suspects this, and I'm sure it's true, because things changed. I trace this to the 1980s. I have a friend who's a restaurateur, and she says that Wolfgang Puck did it. That when he opened his restaurants in Los Angeles and elsewhere, he consciously made them loud, and that restaurateurs do this in a weird way to sort of psychologically back-engineer an impression of vibrant success. That successful places are crowded and loud. Therefore, loud places must be successful. So there's a sort of, you know, faulty syllogism to it. I don't know anyone, as you said, who likes a loud restaurant. One of the reasons that I occasionally go downtown to go to On 20, the restaurant up on the top of the building, it's like walking into 1960. The tables sit like separate continents, you know, far apart from each other across this vast oceans of carpet. It's quiet. You
hear
hushed conversations, the piano tinkling in the background. You don't have to raise your voice. It's just a dream of a restaurant for that
reason.
Because
people can have conversations. You know, how can you possibly have a conversation in a loud restaurant? You know, and then people yell into your ear, and they yell really loud, and they forget that you don't have to speak loudly if you're speaking into somebody's ear.
I was recently out to dinner with friends, and the waiter got 3 out of our 4 orders wrong because they didn't hear what we were saying.
So 1985, look, I graduated from college in 1981. a few years before that, you had graduates of these colleges who were just going on to whatever job they could possibly get. Country was in a recession. Suddenly in the 80s, you've got all these people going from these colleges. They're going to New York City. They're making ridiculous amounts of money for 24-year-olds. Well, these are people whose most recent social milieu was loud, crowded college parties. I mean, when you're 22, you really don't mind being in a huge party where everyone is shouting and screaming. That's your way of life. I honestly believe that the 80s the 80s created this. It happened in places like New York City, and it happened in New York City and a few other cities, and it became a template for a new restaurant ambiance in which success would be identified with the boisterous crowd. It's also expensive, by the way. My friend Dorian Puka, who when he opened Treva, his first restaurant in West Hartford, he said it was great, but it was so loud and people were complaining. And he found out that to, you know, put these noise dampening elements on the ceiling was going to cost a lot of money that he didn't have. Well, he went ahead and did it, and that's why even though Treva is not a quiet restaurant, you can have a conversation, especially in the main room to the left when you go in. That's the he soundproofed that one and works great.
Right. This is all based somewhat anyway on a Vox article that we all read where they did make that point. They first of all blamed Mario Batali for coming up with the idea of having noisy restaurants and having noise that approximates the noise back in the kitchen that Batali and other chefs thought where the people are sitting should sound kind of like the way the kitchen sounded, and they listened to loud music in the kitchen to keep themselves from falling asleep and all this kind of stuff. We're going to take a break pretty soon. I want to just – one of the things that I just observed, this is not really connected to the topic exactly, but it kind of amuses me, that whenever Carolyn talks about dating, she talks about it as something that happens out there. Have you noticed that phrase?
Yeah, it's kind of
you always do that too. You go, yeah, I'm out when I'm out there.
Well, like, I'm not going to say where I was.
I know,
on
but
a
where
date.
Is like is out there like just sort of
like
it
on
sounds,
some restaurant.
It sounds like you're out with orcas.
Or God forbid somebody
like,
took me to a movie.
But it's all this place kind of out there.
I think that phrase traces to Seinfeld. There's an episode where George's parents are separated,
really?
And George's mother is dating. She says, "I'm out there," and George reacts with horror. He says, "You can't be out there because I'm out there. And if you're out there and I'm out there, then I can't
maybe,
be out there."
Maybe that did enter the vernacular from that.
Yeah, okay. So that's good. We solved one problem in the whole
that's
A segment.
That's the bottom of that.
And it wasn't even a problem we knew we were going to attempt to solve. All right. So we have to take a little break to raise some money, and we'd like you to do that to support the show. To help you do that, one of our regular Nose panelists, Jim Chapdelaine, wrote a song to inspire you, which Kate Callahan and I learned badly with him the other day.
2, 3, 4. Coming up's a number you should call it. First you'll find your credit card or wallet. Make sure you pull over if you're driving in a car. It's perfect time to donate to WNPR.
Yes, welcome back to The Nose. On The Nose today, Rand Cooper, Irene Papoulas, and Carolyn Payne. So, and once again, we're in yet another generational chasm here because Rand, Irene, and I are all of an age where the original Lost in Space. Actually, you know what? Let's remind ourselves what Wolfie. Let's go to B3. This is what the original Lost in Space, Carolyn, sounded like.
Dad, come in, Jupiter.
My sensors indicate that the pod's communication system has been effectively jammed, Will Robinson.
Jammed? By what?
There are more jamming potentials on this planet, Will Robinson, than can be computed by my memory banks.
Never fear, Smith is here. We can find our own way to the Jupiter if we can just spot the rock your father mentioned.
Dad told us to stay put.
But we can save time if we meet him halfway. And then, William, you can tell him.
That you were in no way to blame?
Exactly.
All right, Dr. Smith, I'll do my best, but I'm not promising anything.
That's Billy Mumy as Will Robinson. Dr. Zachary Smith is played by Jonathan Harris, and not the one who's running for governor right now. And John Robinson, Will's dad, is played by Guy Williams in that. So it was 1965 or so. The family Robinson was lost in space. The robot looked like, you know, like a reasonably intelligent shop vac or something. And so we've come a long ways. And we might as well hear what it sounds like now. It's been rebooted. It's up on Netflix. The only actor probably that you would recognize, unless you watch House of Cards pretty carefully, would be Parker Posey, who is the new Dr. Smith in a very complicated way. Anyway, here's what the new Lost in Space sounds like.
We're not going anywhere until we clear this out. I'll get Judy to come down and start working on it.
Wait. You think she's ready?
What do you mean ready?
Well, after what happened, you're not worried about her?
I'm worried about a lot of things. Judy's not one of them. She'll pull through. She always does.
Yeah, well, maybe she'll pull through faster if we let her sit this out. I mean, you know, give her time.
We don't have time, John. This part of the glacier is
unstable. Yeah, I know. So is our daughter.
You really think you're the best judge of what she can and can't handle?
Look, I know you and the kids are this team, but if I'm going to be here, you got to let me be here.
It actually is kind of 65 hokey the way that music comes in right at the end. Hey, I know you kids are this team. So that's Mom and Dad Robinson. They haven't really been getting along all that well before this space journey. Dad has been pretty much an absentee action figure kind of guy in the Marines. The story is also told in a very fragmented way. We sort of know what's happened to them, but through flashbacks, we find out that Earth was facing extermination from some kind of comet strike or something like that. I don't know how specific they actually get. People depart. Some people get stuck back on Earth. But the people who depart, they wind up in some other kind of accident. And yes, the family Robinson winds up on an unknown and only partially hospitable planet. Also on that planet is a robot who's sort of like, you know, it was like an orca who could only be friends with one person. It happens to be young Will Robinson. Zachary Smith, as I said, is in a very odd way transformed into the person played by Parker Posey. I don't know. What else do we need to tell them?
That was a great summary so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I think we told them enough then. Well, we should say that in that clip, what you're hearing about is Judy. So there's three children in this family. Judy is the most high-functioning of three pretty high-functioning kids. But she has been through an incredible trauma upon arrival in the planet where she's effectively frozen into ice in kind of a life suit while they frantically try to chip her out when she dies, before she dies. And unlike a lot of people in these action movies, she has a pretty obvious case of PTSD from it. And that's what they're talking about. All right, Irene, you found things to like in this, so maybe you should start.
Well, I liked the psychology of that, and so the PTSD issue, though I have to say that before that, when she was stuck in the ice and you said, okay, this is the first episode, she's going to live, but how could she live if she's frozen in ice and they can't get to her, you know, and they drag that out and drag that out. So that kind of thing really was not for me as a viewer, just like, just the terror and the ice flows falling, crashing on each other for a long drawn out time until like finally, oh my God, they're safe. But there's a psychological complexity, I might even say, or interesting dynamic that they're exploring in the relationship among all the people that I found quite interesting.
All right. Well, maybe we can come back to that. I want to go around the table, though, and see what else or hear what else people thought. I'll go to you next, Rand.
Well, I have a number of thoughts about it on its own terms, and then I have other thoughts that have to do with the nature of the reboot and its relation to the original show. There's plenty for me to like here. I'm not sure that I would continue watching it on its own. We were talking about that off the air, but it's exciting. It's sort of heart pounding. It seems to be one narrow escape after another, and that's well done. The family dynamic you refer to, there's eventually, although it's not much in the first episode, but eventually a kind of winningly witty dialogue appears in the margins of the catastrophes that are being barely avoided, of a sort of reckless, slightly sarcastic grace under pressure repartee among the family members. And I like that. Parker Posey is always a great adverse neurotic character. It's an interesting role for her. She goes to a different level. It's almost a sociopath.
Not almost.
Well, she is a sociopath. And you forget. I mean, it's not really the same oily character that Jonathan Harris played in was so enjoyably hateable in that role. It's different, and she does things of a more seriously dire nature. I mean, you know, killing people. He does that too, actually. But
she has these moments of pause that I think are interesting too.
Yeah.
You know?
There's an inverted, I like this sort of inverted family dynamic where mom is the alpha female and dad is in some ways been relegated to
the
margins.
Think about the kids, think about the feelings.
You know, so that's good. But I guess what I would say is, first of all, I think the creator of this show, although he's not actually the writer director, was Neil Marshall, who is a British or maybe Scottish film director, and he's directed some notable horror movies. A terrific horror movie called The Descent. Any of you guys see that?
I've certainly heard of it. Obviously.
Group of spelunking women who get lost in a cave and trapped in a cave where ghouls are present. And in another film called Dog Soldiers about a British Army unit that's training in Scotland and falls prey to werewolves. I have to wonder, why is it that a director who specializes in sort of heart-pounding terror and suspense would be the appropriate creative force to redo a show that initially was a kind of campy, tongue-in-cheek, funny satire of space exploration? And that's why later, if we get onto this, I think the reboot of the show really says a good deal about our zeitgeist now and kinds of tongue-in-cheek humor that we don't like anymore.
I want to talk about that. But first, Carolyn, you come to this with no generational baggage. This is just a show that Netflix
put on. Only thing I knew about Lost in Space was that there's the catchphrase, Danger, Will Robinson. That's pretty much all I knew about this going into it. And sci-fi is my least favorite genre. So already, like, there were two strikes against this. And, I mean, I suffered through and did my duty and watched three episodes. I would not, unless I was being paid or threatened, watch any more of this. And so when I saw Parker Posey, when, you know, the first scene where you see her, I was like, oh, maybe things are looking up. And I'm a huge Parker Posey fan. I think she is a fascinating actress and comedian. And even she couldn't sell this to me. And I do think, like, she was given a really fascinating character. But I felt like this was not, for some reason, she's not, she couldn't even, like, latch me into this. And I kind of felt that way with all the characters. Like, even the robot feels, like, cold to me.
But I think that's very – I mean, I think that goes back to the moment we're in. So I think in 1965 it was possible to imagine a friendly robot who would be our pet, you know, which is what the robot kind of is. You know, this is a little bit more – this robot, once again, it bonds for complicated reasons with a little boy, Will Robinson. And it's not necessarily clear – and even Will Robinson mentions this – that the robot wouldn't hurt somebody else. Will knows the robot won't hurt him, but he didn't really know anything about this robot. And I do think, Irene, this particular thing is meant to plug into our current anxieties about robotics and about artificial intelligence. I mean, we don't see robots right now as creatures that are going to go fetch our shoes and pipe. Robots are things that...
Well, like that scene where the robot locks Will in the room.
Right.
You know, and even because the robot, it's established that the robot does whatever Will says. Like, at one point, like, Will almost has this robot just walk off a cliff.
Right.
But this robot locks him in the room and he can't even, you know.
And is it to save him or is it not to save
him?
Right.
I think it is to save him. The robot's a one-man dog.
Well, okay. But I think part of the link to our time is the idea of moral ambiguity. And that's, to that extent, I think there's a sort of, mixed message in terms of who the audience is for this, you know, because in a way it's a show that I wish I could have watched with my son when he was like 8 or 10 years old, and it's like a great adventure and all that. But then he was really, would have been really disturbed, I think, by the moral ambiguity, you know, like not knowing the good guys from the bad guys. But that's our time. We don't really know the good guys from the bad guys, and you can't trust anyone. And so that's why even the Parker Posey, she's completely a bad guy, but then she has these flashes, and what's going on with that? And, you know, so to that extent, I think there's like this anxiety, level of anxiety, like you can't be sure, that really seems like part of our zeitgeist.
Can I just seize on a key word that both you, Colin, and Irene mentioned, that is anxiety. You said the robot in the current one plugs into our anxiety about, you know, artificial intelligence and so on. The one thing that the old show and many shows of 1965 of this kind were definitely not designed to do was to plug into our anxiety about anything. And Mike Hale, the television critic in the Times, writing about the show, referred to the original as a scary monster camp fest that started out as a sort of earnest science exploration clunker, and then as it found its proper gear, morphed into this scary monster camp fest. And the remake is anything but campy. There is my wife grew up watching the original one, and she watched the first episode of this, and she basically spent the whole hour saying, no, no. in the very first episode, you think about the sort of angst and anxiety-producing things that happen to people. There's more angst in one show than there was in the entire X number of years of the original. People are crushed. They're drowned to death. They're trapped in tight spaces. They're frozen to death. They're attacked
by broken
eels.
Leg in the first 3 minutes.
Broken legs that has to be then surgically repaired by the child of the person whose leg it is.
Who happens to know how to do that.
People are dropped off.
Right.
People are dropped off cliffs.
Also, the chicken. By the time the chicken entered in the second episode, I became fixated on the chicken.
Yeah, there is an actual live chicken.
So my question about what we're doing, and I would say the same thing is true about, for instance, very notably, Batman. The original Batman show was just a pure exercise in pure camp. Now, look at Batman now. It's so dire. And I would also say the same is true for James Bond. A lot of people like Daniel Craig. I think Daniel Craig is a good James Bond. But James Bond now, today, is not the same sort of winking. These productions no longer wink at us. They use awesome special.
They're feeding on our anxiety.
Well, and then like you know, James Bond now, Daniel Craig seems like he's just a ruthless killer.
Yeah, I would amplify that and say so. I've been struggling a little bit with the Parker Posey character playing Dr. Zachary Smith. She steals somebody's jacket very early in the film. We just found out that it's actually Billy Mumy is the actor who plays basically a dead guy that she takes the jacket from to change her identity. You know, and so Carolyn, the original Lost in Space, this character. Well, let me just quickly tell a very very fast story. So I'm in the studio next door when this is years ago one day, and the building starts to shake, and it's clear we're having an earthquake, and Kyone is there in the booth, and I've got a guest in the room whose eyes are like the size of saucers, and there's other people around, and I'm thinking, well, you know, there's only like 3 minutes left in the show. You know, what should I do? Or like three or 4 minutes left of the show. And the one thing that was popping through my head is I cannot be Dr. Zachary Smith in this situation. Because Dr. Zachary Smith would say, Kyone, stay at the board. I must go. And then run out of the building. and he was kind of this comically, I mean, in addition to being kind of a sociopath, he was a real coward. You don't really see cowards as much anymore. And cowards aren't funny anymore. Right. They're the guys who don't run into Parkland to save the kids. And sociopaths get you killed. And that's our view of them these days. There's nothing funny about that. These are the people that you really have to worry about because we've gotten smarter about identifying the cowards and sociopaths in our lives who will get us killed. Except when we're in a really noisy restaurant on a date with one of them.
And you just don't know. You didn't hear them. You never picked up on it.
Yeah, I mean, somebody's tweeting at us, Irene, that this thing needs is humor. And there's banter, right? But there's not humor.
There wasn't enough.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, it's designed to have your heart pounding and racing. The old Lost
in
Space was designed
to
have you chuckling.
Yeah, but it also, the pacing, it was like heart racing, but also slow.
Yes.
So it was.
That's true. That is true.
I agree. There's definitely a pacing problem. Anyways, the reboot of Lost in Space, we're going to take a break here pretty soon. I guess we don't 100. The one thing, I have to mention one other thing about this, which is I think the other anxiety or something that is there in this movie is kind of there's, I mean, the mother is kind of a tiger mom. She's like a non-Asian tiger mom who's like forced her kids to these incredible levels of achievement. Will Robinson at one point says that he had tested into a geology program or something. This movie is very much about like how to get your kids into Ivy League schools, except that the Ivy League school turns out to be this incredibly hostile planet. Anyway, we have to take a break. We'll come back. We'll make some recommendations.
Today's show was... Can you even hear me? Today's show was produced at first by Jonathan McPants. No, I didn't ask you to dance. Anyway, he went to Colorado, so Betsy Kaplan. No, I don't want to order an Etsy captain. Betsy Kaplan! Amanda Fish was... No, I'm not the waitress. You can't order fish from me. The part of Bill Curry was played by Frank Ocean. What? Okay, if Frankenstein was what you heard, that's fine. On Monday's show, the scramble is... You know what? Never mind.
All right, so those were the credits. That was Kyone. We're back. We're with our panel, Rand Cooper, Irene Mapoulos, Carolyn Payne. We're going to make some recommendations. Carolyn, why don't you go first?
Okay, so last weekend I saw Age of Innocence at Hartford Stage, and I really liked it a lot. I mean, it's just it's very like lush, and it is kind of it's a nice evening of escapism. Like if you don't want to have things tapping into your anxiety, this is a good one to see. So I would recommend that.
All right. I wasn't expecting it. Edith Wharton.
I know. I did not go to it willingly, I will add, but I did like it. So
you go to so many things unwillingly.
Yes.
Yeah. I really just want to sit home and watch Real Housewives of New York.
Right. This is the person who does like the Sharknado marathons.
I live for Shark Week.
That's where her heart lies. All right, Irene Papoulos, what do you have for us?
I have, apropos of nothing we've been talking about, if you're interested in North Korea and what's going on, I read this article in the New York Review of Books. It's easily available online, called Jaw Jaw Better Than War War by Jessica T. Matthews. And for somebody who is interested in the news but doesn't know much about what exactly the details are about the countries surrounding North Korea and their attitudes towards the U.S., it's a really good article. Also, there's this incredible organist named Christopher Houlihan. I wouldn't think of organ music as something that I would love, but he's an incredibly bright star of an organ player. He's from Connecticut. He went to Trinity. He went to Juilliard. He made it big as an organist, and now he's giving a concert at Trinity tonight at 7:30 with Bach and Schumann. And if you like that kind of thing, he just is the best organist you're ever going to see in your life.
Or hear in your life. Doesn't he like host a show on public radio, too?
Not that I know of, but he might.
I think he does. Anyway, wow. Christopher Houlihan at Trinity tonight. Is that where he is?
At Trinity tonight at 7:30 in the chapel.
It might be exactly what you need to lift your spirits instead of tapping into your anxieties. What are you going to tap into, Rand?
Food.
Okay.
I have two culinary recommendations. One is a restaurant recommendation. By the way, starting in June, I'm going to be reviewing restaurants. I used to do that for The Times, as you know, but now I'll be doing it for Hartford Magazine. And the first restaurant I'm going to review is Bistro on Main in Manchester. And it's right in the Main Street of Manchester. It's a terrific neighborhood bistro. I will say it's very loud on a weekend, but on a weeknight, it's not loud. And if you go, I actually have two dishes to recommend. It's a terrific bouillabaisse. And there's also a lamb tagine that is just great. So that's Bistro on Main in Manchester. The other thing is May 12th at the Connecticut Forum is doing a chef forum. And it's hosted by Sam Sifton, who's the excellent food editor of the New York Times. And it's going to feature Tom Colicchio, who you probably know from watching Iron Chef. He used to be the Gramercy Park, the chef who opened Gramercy Park and then went on to the Kraft steak restaurants, and also Gabrielle Hamilton of the restaurant in the East Village called Prune, which is a terrific, cozy, lovely little restaurant. And the third, I think, is David Chang, the Momofuku of Momofuku fame. And so that for anyone interested in restaurants and the lives of chefs, and that should be a great evening. Connecticut Forum, May 12th.
I'm pretty sure with help from Wilfie that I was confusing Christopher Houlihan with Christopher O'Reilly. But I'm still not 100% sure. All right, so that all sounds great. Connecticut Forum. I was lucky enough to host the one with Anthony Bourdain and Alice Waters and Duff Goldman. My panelists, at one point, there was a big bowl of fruit out there on the stage, and they started throwing fruit at each other, which I consider to be kind of an accomplishment as a host, as a moderator. I'm going to recommend that people check out online. Time does this most influential people of 2018, and it's up there right now. And what they do is time-worn practice, but they have one famous person write about another famous person. And they're very short. So you actually have Rosie O'Donnell writing about Roseanne Barr. Think about that. But writing approvingly about Roseanne Barr. Barack Obama writes about, by name, Emma Gonzalez and I think three or four of the other Parkland activists. Chris Borland, he's a former NFL football player for the 49ers who quit after like one fabulous year because he was worried about his brain, writes about Anne McKee, who is the researcher who's done the most significant research about chronic encephalopathy in football players. Lupita Nyong'o writes about Trevor Noah and so forth and so on. So it's nicely done, and these little write-ups are easy to get through. And there's a lot of people. It kind of gets back to the Kendrick Lamar thing, which is that a lot of the people in this in these 100 influential Americans are people that you don't know. I guess the people in the world. I can't remember whether it's Americans or the world. But they're people that you don't know, names you might not recognize. If you read all of them, you'd have a pretty good handle, I think, on what's going on in culture and politics and science and stuff like that. If you read all of them, it's a nice roundup. I am going to end with I'm going to recommend something for the third time on this show, and then I'm going to give up. But I think, like a lot of things on television these days and a lot of things in culture, Bill Curry is always complaining about this. It's all based on comic books. It's all science fiction, which Carolyn's not crazy about. There's so much stuff out there that's about that, you know, fantasy, stuff that used to be the province of children. And I like a lot of that stuff. But every once in a while, you find something that isn't like that. And there was a series, I think it was originally on the Sundance Channel, but it migrated to Netflix. The four seasons are archived there. It's called Rectify. It is about a man who is wrongfully imprisoned and gets out after 19 years and tries to rejoin his family. It is, I just think it's one of the maybe six or seven best things I've ever seen on television. I slowly kind of doled out the last few episodes to myself because I didn't want it to end. One of the last things that happens is part of the family packs up a tire shop that the family has owned. I was weeping at the packing up of this tire shop, which you wouldn't think would be a particularly emotional experience. You know, it's just that thing, that human scale drama that we're not doing that well or as well as we used to. So I do recommend that. It's not zany. It's not crazy. It's quiet. It's thoughtful. And it's has some pretty important stuff in it, too. So Rectify. This will be my last time urging people to watch this. Thanks so much to everybody who helped out here today, especially Betsy Kaplan, who took over the producing, Wolfie on the board, and, of course, Carolyn Payne, Irene Papoulos, and Rand Cooper.